This is the Infotagem podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. We've seen how disinformation campaigns have spread false information about the coronavirus, sustained anti-vaccine conspiracy theories, and tried to interfere in elections around the world. Has enough been done to combat this threat? Also, as the major social media platforms are advertising businesses, do the world's major brands have more influence on removing harmful content than citizens do? I'm Damien Collins, and I'll be joined on this Infotagem podcast by Renee DiResta, who is the Technical Research Manager at the Stanford Internet Observatory in California, and Tom Firth, Managing Director of the M&C Saatchi Advertising Agency in London. Renee, it's great to have you on the Infotagem podcast. And I wanted to start off really asking you about sort of where we are now, the kind of landscape as you see it, because we're in the middle of a global pandemic. There's a very big election coming up in America in November. And a lot of the discussions we've been having in the last few months on this podcast have been about whether we can combat disinformation, whether the social media companies take harmful content and disinformation seriously enough. And looking at where we are now, do you think that enough has been done to stop a big interference in the American election like we saw in 2016? Do you think it could happen again?
Well, we've made a lot of progress since 2016, I think. There's a lot more in the way of, first, people actively looking for it. Second, kind of integrity teams at the platform companies, organizations within our government and our national security entities, military, intelligence community that are focused on it. So as far as the threat of foreign actors, there's a little bit more in the way of a robust partnership with multi-stakeholder actors participating in ensuring the integrity of our elections. That said, the incentive is still there, and that's never going to go away, which means that we have to be thinking not in terms of have we built systems to mitigate the threat as it was in 2016, but rather are we thinking creatively enough about newer or more innovative ways or areas that we haven't patched, so to speak, that still afford an opportunity. And I think that this is one of the areas that that we think about a lot at Stanford Internet Observatory, which is now that we've made certain policy changes, now that we have certain types of integrity teams looking for certain signatures, how will the adversaries evolve? And that's kind of an ongoing question. How do we red team that out? The other thing we're interested in the US, of course, is that line around inauthentic behavior and frameworks that were put in place to mitigate interference from foreign actors does not necessarily apply to similar playbooks being run by domestic actors. And this is, of course, an ongoing challenge as well, which is that norms and laws haven't really kept up with advances in communication ecosystem infrastructure that we have from social platforms now. So how do we think about where the line is between just coordinated activism by domestic groups versus manipulative behavior?
So this is kind of in some ways like the, and it's the Facebook equivalent of Al Capone being done for tax evasion, and that bad accounts are taken down not because they're doing bad things, but because they're inauthentic.
It's a challenge. So inauthenticity, we have to get away from inauthenticity of the account. We've already seen from Russia and Africa, and in October of last year, my team put out some great work looking at how Prigozhin's entities operating in Sudan, in Libya, and a number of countries in Africa had resorted to what we call franchising. So actually hiring locals to help run their pages, which means that instead of running a fake, instead of the page being run by a fake persona out of St. Petersburg, it's being run by a real person. The degree of wittingness is, kind of a matter of some debate. But for the platform point of view, the question becomes, can you take a holistic view of this activity and identify whether we still consider it manipulative if the account is legitimate? And this is where we've begun to look at things like the behaviors of the accounts and the behaviors of, domains they may be affiliated with, to try to do a better job of understanding how very old tactics like financially supported propaganda sites that are not necessarily attributable to the Russian government directly are, you know, leveraged and incorporated into these operations in a digital playing field.
I mean, so when we think about, well, certainly when I think about the Russian interference in 2016 in the presidential election, and you know, we think about ads, I mean, but that's because that was what was found, and that was what the Senate Intelligence Committee asked for and what Facebook were prepared to offer. But that doesn't mean, of course, that was the extent of the Russian interference at the time. And I remember asking Facebook during the course of our Select Committee inquiry in 2018, you know, what the role of groups were on Facebook. And I was told then, well, you know, you can't, the only way you can drive content through the platform is through advertising. But do you think that is the case? And should we be paying a bigger interest in what goes on in coordinated networks and accounts, and particularly groups with very big audiences?
Sure. So I did some of the investigation. I led one of the outside teams for the Senate Intelligence Committee. So I've seen the full data set. And one of the things that is quite obvious from it actually is the extent to which the ads were used to drive people to the pages and groups, meaning the ads were used to grow audiences. So the ads, while they did have fairly, actually quite good in many cases, click-through rates for the demographic groups they were targeting, what you did see was the organic content was much more impactful, was much more significant, and that's because they did a good job targeting their audience, pushing them to their pages, and then continuing to propagandize and to engage by way of those pages. So once you've segmented your community down and you know that I want to reach African Americans in Pennsylvania, or I want to reach Texas secessionists in Texas, you know, once you have that audience established, you can continue to provide them with content they're receptive to. And that's the value of the continued sustained organic engagement. Now, one of the things that is a challenge that we do see is that since ads have gotten harder to run, since we've had the platforms begin to, you know, to take some steps with Facebook, now you have to get verified in certain ways, you know, validate your address and identity in many ways to run political ads. What we see is that you can still, if you want to amass an audience, go into places where these audiences already exist. And that's the kind of vulnerability of groups. So because, excuse me, of our very normal, you know, kind of human behavior on the internet, people do tend to kind of self-select into groups and communities that they want to be a part of. And they telegraph that interest, that identity, by joining a group with a name like Blue Lives Matter or Texas Secessionists or Black Lives Matter. And so they're kind of telegraphing their interest, they're joining that community. And that means that if inauthentic accounts or manipulative accounts join those communities, they can push content into those communities. So the question is always, you know, we actually see spammers doing this quite a bit. We've seen some Blue Lives Matter spam networks operated out of kind of a host of Eastern European countries that were really financially motivated, that weren't politically motivated at all, but they were using this tactic and they were able to, in turn, kind of drive people back to their sites. So this is kind of a function of how humans organize on the internet. It's kind of a bigger challenge than disinformation. It's just that it's a threat vector by which bad actors can take advantage of that behavior.
Sure. And I mean, a lot of what we've been talking about so far, and I think before this year, a lot of the focus on investigating disinformation seemed to be about different aspects of political speech, some of them very extreme, admittedly, and potentially inherently harmful, but nevertheless, you know, political in its origin. I think there's been a much bigger focus now on disinformation relating to coronavirus, because there's a public health emergency. And in turn, I think that seems to have shone a much brighter light on the problem of the anti-vax movement and this effect of, you know, communities and groups that have things in common that collect and gather online. I think is quite problematic when you consider that those sorts of networks are being used to disseminate anti-vaccine messaging, many of which, you know, most of which is highly dubious and misleading, and in the context of a pandemic could actually be very harmful to public health.
I think that's true. I think, you know, some of my earliest work, the way I actually got into studying how information moved online was actually as an activist myself working on passing a law in California to eliminate vaccine opt-outs for school. We used to have this weird system where you could just decide, you know, my personal belief said I don't have to get vaccinated and then you wouldn't have to vaccinate your children to send them to school. So I thought that was a terrible loophole. I got involved in the mission to change that law. And one of the things we saw, this was back in 2015, was the extent to which the anti-vaccine movement was extraordinarily well-networked in a way that the public health communities just were not. The public health communities were not participating in the same conversations. They didn't have the same reach on social media. They didn't really prioritize social media. You know, our CDC actually really kind of dropped the ball on developing modern communication strategy, I would say. And one of the challenges now is that in this era of network activism and in this network, you know, in this era where what you see is a sort of, you see people kind of serving as conduits between these, we can call them, you know, kind of like the overlapping Venn diagrams of interests that they have. So you see anti-vaccine related content making its way into other communities by way of individual people who have interest in both things. And then they share the content from one group into the other. The other thing that we see is because this behavior is happening among real people, algorithmic systems do kind of pick up on it. And so you do see recommendation engines promoting anti-vaccine accounts or anti-vaccine adjacent accounts because an individual has indicated an interest in or engaged with content from the anti-vaccine movement. So there's a, you know, in the US we have the conspiracy theory QAnon. There is, of course, a sufficient amount of conspiratorial overlap between some of the anti-vaccine conspiracies and some of the QAnon conspiracies. And so you see that these kind of big pieces of misinformation, we'll call them, you know, major videos, things like Plandemic, kind of hopping from one community to the next. And that's because that's sort of what the social infrastructure is designed to do at this point. So for a long time, that problem was treated as just an issue of free expression. Well, you know, in the United States in particular, of course, you have a right to be, you have a right to believe whatever crazy thing you want and to say it most of the time. And so that kind of content was really left alone for a period of many, many years, in large part because the platforms weren't really looking at downstream harms. They were looking solely at free expression. And striking that balance during a pandemic has been something that they've had to kind of rethink.
I think what you said there really sort of, I think, puts put your finger on the issue, which is that it's not, to me, it doesn't seem to be, this is just about free speech. It's about the amplification of that speech that the tools created by the social media companies allow. They allow that speech to spread in ways that it wouldn't do organically. It's doing it because it's being recommended and promoted, and the tools that were created really to, you know, support what is an ad business and to target people with ad messages for consumer products can be just as effectively used to spread anti-vaccine ideas and other conspiracy theories. And I mean, do you feel that this all comes back to that it's the business model and the design of these systems, and therefore, if it is, should we not hold the companies to account for the ways in which they've allowed these tools to be used?
Sure. I think, yes, it is a function of incentive structures and design, right? And so in terms of incentive structures, the platform monetizes if you're kept on the platform longer. So it can serve you more refined, more targeted ads, the better it understands you. And one thing that we do see with that, so there's that kind of incentive structure piece. There's the design, which is, in order to keep you engaged, building tools for you to easily create content, meaning upload a photo or, you know, put up a status or whatever, and the ability to participate in the sharing process, to feel like you're really actively involved as a member of a community, like you have a voice and you can share the things that are important to you. That it does meet kind of a deep-seated need or desire that people have, particularly in this time during the pandemic, as everyone's very, you know, looking for information and actively engaging in these communities, in part because, honestly, you know, government and health communicators failed for a long time to actually get information out there in effective and responsible ways. And so you have this system where the intersection of the ability to spread information very quickly, the kind of velocity and virality challenges intersect with their, you know, monetization strategy in such a way that the, for a very long time, not paying attention was a perfectly viable business strategy. It wasn't until there was a pretty major public sentiment shift in the US in particular after the 2016 election, kind of calling for a reckoning with some of these issues. I think the question of how to regulate, you know, in the US we have very particular alignment around speech and expression. And that's led to some very real tensions, even with our regulators. You know, there's a big antitrust hearing today. And while the focus is nominally antitrust, I would be willing to bet that a significant part of the questioning winds up being around content moderation, which has been a very, very big topic of conversation here in the US, particularly because you know, our two major political parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, have a very different view on how platforms should be moderating content. And so each wants to do more regulating, but the outcomes that they want are in fact quite different. You know, the Democrats want to see more in the way of regulation of what they consider to be harmful speech, hate speech, you know, other types you know, that sort of viral mass reach that we were describing. Whereas the conservatives, the Republican Party, believes that conservative voices are censored in large part because many of the moderation, you know, many high profile moderation cases have taken down right wing conspiracy theorists. And so they in turn want to see something indicating that the platforms are not ideologically biased against conservatives. So in some ways that translates to less moderation. And so we have a, you know, an environment in the US where everybody thinks they should be regulated, but nobody agrees on, you know, in what way or by what mechanism.
Absolutely, it should be a lively set of hearings. Hearing today, I'm sure. Tom Firth, I just wanted to bring you in at this point. With an agency like MNC Saatchi, and when we were colleagues there, what's now increasingly a large number of years ago, social media was in its infancy, and if a government was confronted with a major public health emergency, just like it was, say, in the 80s with the AIDS virus, then there were certain levers you could pull. You could run a really big advertising campaign on newspaper ads and posters and on television, and you could be pretty certain you would reach the country. It's a lot more complicated now because people spend much less of their time on traditional media and much more of it in social media. And does that make the task of communicating with people harder now, do you think?
I suppose in a way it does. It's harder to get mass reach quickly, and it's also harder to control the narrative as well, I think. Because as you say, Damien, it, back in the 80s, it was all quite one direction. This is information that we are telling you. And that's not the way communication works now. Obviously, many voices can become part of the conversation, and there isn't a sort of dominant voice that can control and lead it. So there's a danger of the message getting lost with competing opinions and competing bits of advice, which is obviously a particular concern in the times we're in at the moment with this pandemic and some of the misinformation around what you need to be doing to protect yourself and others from the COVID.
Absolutely. And I think, with the anti-vax campaign, I mean, I think one of the problems we could face is that the government or other public health agencies could be running campaigns to say, we've got a vaccine, you should take it, this is what you need to do. And then there could be an aggressive campaign against that on social media, telling people that if they take the vaccine, it's going to kill their children. And indeed, we've already seen some examples of that online already. Now, I mean, one of the big differences between the online world and the offline world is this subject of regulation, as Renee has touched on. And if you ran an ad for clients on television or on radio or on billboards or in the press, there are, ultimately it's regulated in some way, isn't it? I mean, sometimes you have to get pre-clearance.
Yeah. It can be, there's a code we have to work to.
There's a code you have to work to.
You get pre-approval.
Yeah, but if you run ads on Facebook, then there's no pre-approval, and in fact they're saying they won't even challenge or take down ads, even if the claims in them are false. And do you think that needs to be corrected? Do you think there needs to be a leveling of the playing field here?
Well, working with Facebook, I mean, they do have quite a strict code. So you do have to adhere to a code that does inform the kind of content that you can put into advertising. So there is some control that they bring to the process of getting ads up. So it's not complete sort of open season, as it were. It's not totally the Wild West.
But do you have to sort of demonstrate? I mean, obviously, in political advertising here is not regulated, unlike other forms of advertising. One of the controversies in America has been, in particular, has been around Facebook saying they won't challenge political ads, the facts in political ads. I mean, and do you find, is there the same sort of scrutiny for claims in consumer ads that run on social media as there would be if you were putting them in traditional media?
No, that's definitely true. There isn't the same level of scrutiny. So if you put, if you go onto television or radio here, you have to pre-submit the content, and that is reviewed, and questions are asked, and you have to validate the claims that are made. So there is not that level of scrutiny in social, no.
But even in print, I mean, you don't have to. I mean, I don't believe you have to pre-submit print ads, but you can still have a complaint taken out against you afterwards, make you withdraw the ads or face some sort of sanction after the event.
That's true. Yeah, yeah.
Which again wouldn't apply on social media. I mean, one of the things is that's become hot topic in the last few weeks, and I noticed is the Stop Hate for Profit campaign in America, and I noticed that. That's now being rolled into the UK, and they're equally making a pitch to UK brands to pause their advertising on Facebook. I mean, this seems to be a really big step. If really big clients like Coca-Cola, Adidas, Unilever are pausing their advertising on Facebook, it must suggest that brands are increasingly concerned about their ads appearing alongside content they wouldn't want to be seen with.
Well, yeah, and they're right to be concerned. I mean, the research I've seen suggests that consumers expect brands to take responsibility for the content that they're sitting alongside. So if a brand finds itself in amongst content which is unsavory or hateful or whatever it is, then consumers don't like it, and there's a serious risk that begins to impact on the relationship that they have with the brand. So I think they absolutely should be concerned. And I think that coupled with the sort of social conscience, of the sort of awakening that's come from Black Lives Matter, I think has come together to sort of to see brands being actively responsible in a way that perhaps we haven't for before, or certainly some of these very large brands.
And are these issues that your clients raise with you at MNC Saatchi?
Well, yes. I think what we like to think we do is help build and maintain strong, successful brands. And so any issues which pose a challenge to that are part of the conversation that we have over time with our clients. So, we work to try and help our brands continue to flourish wherever they are in whatever context that they're operating in.
I noticed that this week that Campaign reported that the digital ad market is now more than 50% of the global ad market, which is incredible, not surprising. I mean, do you think that COVID in particular is accelerating the drive to online media at the expense of traditional media, should we say?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think that's been a trend for some time, and I think the COVID lockdown has accelerated it for sure. Although the boundaries between the channels were beginning to blur and have been blurred for a long, long time. What is digital? What is traditional? It's all sort of collapsing in on itself a little bit. So yeah, I think it's accelerated an existing trend.
I mean, I think it's a good point. It's one we've touched on in the podcast series before, which is that to younger people in particular, for whom YouTube is their most popular channel, I mean, they probably wouldn't even distinguish between traditional television and services like YouTube, because it's all audiovisual content that they consume through the same device when they want to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think. Yeah, if you having grown up in a quite a sort of segmented and demarcated world of media, it's changed. It's all very sort of interconnected and interlinked, and people move from one into the other very quickly, and sometimes simultaneously. So you can be watching TV and be on social all at the same time. So yeah, that's certainly true.
I mean, Renee, if I could just ask a question for you as well. I mean, do you think one of the problems is that the tech sector, particularly social media, has grown so fast that the sort of checks and balances we put in place with traditional media over the years to try and make sure that the power of media wasn't abused in the wrong hands, they've not been read across into the internet world, and therefore these checks and balances just don't exist. I mean, in other media, we've come up with ways, not necessarily to regulate free speech, but to make sure that free speech isn't used to cause undue harm to other people.
I think that's very true. I think there's so much of it. The adoption curves were so rapid. And the interesting thing with the social platforms as well is that they were really able to amass massive audiences, sustained audiences, where every type of person was reachable on the same platform. So it was sort of, one ad interface could kind of put you into the, digital screen or the home of any type of person you wanted to reach anywhere around the world. And that's, I'm not an advertiser, so I'll defer to someone else here, but that's different than having to decide, which markets you're going to go buy into or which radio stations, reach the zip codes you care about in the US or over, wherever your market is. And so that centralization of audiences all in one place was kind of a remarkable thing. And it's in part because what the platforms did was they actually designed a place where people wanted to be. So the incentive, the kind of network effects of, all of my friends are on here, spending their time on here, ergo I will be as well, is a very powerful motivator. And so it just became a, by virtue of offering a space that people wanted to connect in and doing it, we can of course discuss the if you're not the that you are the product kind of model, but in terms of, for most people it feels very free to participate, and so that's where you see that again, that kind of human incentive being something that the platforms are able to monetize on.
Yeah, it's, I think that's right. I mean, do you think the Stop Hate for Profit campaign has been quite remarkable in terms of its success in getting companies to sign up to it, but in some ways, it also highlights the part of the problem here, which is that for lack of having any clear rules of the road, we could see content moderation decisions being made based on how many advertisers make a fuss about it, rather than what are the policies that we're trying to follow here.
Right, I think that's true. I'd be curious to hear hear your perspective on that, actually, as someone who regulates. But I think it is the people setting up boycotts and working to nudge corporations toward particular social responsibility movements, that's not new, of course. It's interesting to see it taking hold now, I think, and really a testament to Black Lives Matter, which actually started and grew in large part because of this ability to have social reach, because of this ability to go kind of direct to the public. I mean, these are tools that are phenomenally powerful for movement building, and the corporations are in some ways kind of, I think, they're in the same space, and so they're along for the ride, and so they have to decide how they're going to use their power, given the movements that are driving activism.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Tom, perhaps just in finishing here, how effective do you think the brand's response is in this market? I mean, do you think brands have got the power to ultimately shape the way social media works, or will they just be companies that ultimately need to reach their customers? And if they have to abide by rules that have been created by Mark Zuckerberg, they just will.
It's a very good question. I think we're all waiting to see how things develop. I do think there is a sense of responsibility that's evident at the moment, where large organizations and brands are sort of recognizing that they have a responsibility to do positive, constructive things with, how they make and sell and market their products and services. And that's a good thing. I think there's a cause for optimism inspired by what's happening at the moment. But they are commercial enterprises as well, and they operate under quite intense commercial pressure. So we'll see how things develop. There's that great saying about a principle only being a principle if it costs you something. So we'll see, because the boycott, Stop Hate for Profit, as a lot of brands have officially signed up to that, but there are a number of others who have stopped spending who are slightly distanced from it. That they're sort of stated as a month. Some brands have said they'll stop for the whole year, until the end of the year, until the election cycle is complete, actually, which it feels to me like a way of removing themselves from what's going to be quite a sort of hostile and negative conversation, and probably not a place that a brand would like to be unless it has to be. So it'll be interesting to see how many come back after a month, or come back after the time period they said they'll be away, if Facebook has not introduced significant changes. And at the moment, it doesn't look like they're going to. So it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out. Will it be just a one-month flash in the pan, or will something much more significant and substantial happen if these brands take a stand? It's also worth saying that there are some huge brands involved here with lots of spend, but even so, it's a relatively modest percentage of Facebook's overall revenue. I mean, I think it was something like almost 80 billion last year, and 90% of that, I think, comes from smaller, it's a very, very long tail, basically, so smaller businesses. So even though these big brands will hurt Facebook, it's in a position to carry on, and unless the boycott begins to extend into that long tail.
Yeah, it is astonishing that, as you said, it's how long that tail is. I mean, in the old days, there was, I suppose, always a balance between the commercial interests of big media companies and the big brands, and there was a certain similarity in size. But now, the power really does lie with these bigger big social media companies.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth saying, Damien, and I know this is not, it's just like counter to the narrative of quite a lot of your podcasts, but Facebook, from an advertising perspective, is a brilliant platform, because, you know, it's huge. It's got lots of people who are very, very engaged and very active, and very interactive. So it's a very good platform for brands to not only drive awareness, but also drive response. So it is a good advertising platform, I guess. So you can see the draw of that, yeah, to advertisers, I suppose.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's probably the most, you know, one of the most sophisticated bits of ad tech ever created, and that's plugged into the homes of 2 billion users. I suppose the question I think comes up is that when tools that have really been perfected to sell people stuff can also be used to propagate ideas, movements that could actually cause real harm to people and society, and therefore what sort of responsibility should they exercise over this tremendous power that they're giving themselves? Renee, I don't know if you have some sort of closing thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, well, you know, those my takeaways I mentioned in 2015 when I was all of a sudden running this activist campaign myself, right? I made a Facebook page. You know, we were just like a group of moms who wanted to get something done. And when we realized we had to suddenly grow an audience and get people calling our congressmen to, you know, to support the law we wanted to pass to eliminate these vaccine opt-outs, Facebook was the obvious choice, right? And with a couple thousand dollars and some, you know, make a Facebook page. We didn't even file, in the US a C3, like a nonprofit designation or anything, because we didn't know if we needed to even be an organization at this point, because there was the idea that, well, we could reach anybody. So legally, you know, was there a requirement to also be a nonprofit if we just wanted to set up something for political activism for one brief law, one brief moment in time for, you know, 6 months? And it, for me, it opened up a lot of questions around, you know, the ease with which I could do it, the phenomenal targeting ability that I suddenly had, both zip code based, you know, I could target according to zip code, call your congressman with a very personalized ad, ways in which I could find medical professionals by ad targeting to people in the medical field saying, hey, you know, we'd love to get doctors calling in, you know, to support our bill. It really, for me, was a very transformative hands-on experience in how to use this tool for digital activism in a way that I just simply wouldn't have had access to otherwise. And so I think that there's a, you know, phenomenal power there. And so the complete lack of guardrails in 2015, I think, was a little bit on the alarming side also, which is kind of why I'm in some ways involved in the work that I do now. But at the same time, there is that recognition that in some ways, like this, you know, these platforms have been phenomenally powerful in shaping societies at this point, and in large part because they democratized that access. They reduced those barriers to activism. And so the thinking as we think about regulation is how to not regulate according to this is the activism I personally want to see in the world, right? This is my personal alignment. And instead think about it from the standpoint of what do these tools enable? What are the kind of best and worst case scenarios in that, you know, in that enablement? And how do we come up with moderation frameworks, like almost as a self-regulatory, you know, framework, but also official regulatory frameworks, you know, creating a sense of responsibility and obligation to be thinking in terms of ensuring both that they're not manipulated by bad actors and also that they're not manipulated, I think, period at this point.
Absolutely. That's a good point on which to close the podcast today. Renee and Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Infotagem podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, and featuring Renee DiResta and Tom Firth. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagem, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagem.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you until next time.